welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Amy Beecham, and I'm the marketing director here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is strategies to protect your client's IRA using Medicaid annuities, hosted by our founder and CEO, Dale Kraus. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, you can go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's slide deck can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will appear on your screen at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate your feedback. And now we'll get to the presentation. Dale, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, again, my name is Dale Kraus, and I've been practicing in elder law estate planning now. It's my 40th year, and quite a few years ago in the 90s, I established Kraus Financial Services after developing one of the first Medicaid-compliant annuities. My goal at the time in establishing the practice was to help other attorneys get the products they needed in order to do Medicaid planning. Because again, as an estate planner, I learned very quickly that my estate planning practice was enhanced by the fact that if we address long-term care, and typically, you know, I know the best way to do it is with long-term care insurance, but for many of the clients that were associated to the practice that I was with, you know, they didn't do any type of long-term care insurance planning. And so their default mechanism was to find a way to get on Medicaid. And after working with some of those families and designing the first Medicaid-compliant annuity, I took it national through NALA, and other attorneys said, what are you doing for your clients with estate plans that suddenly are impacted by a nursing home stay? And I said, well, this is the product I developed. This is how I use it. And so I spent the next 20, 30 years educating attorneys on the proper use of products, especially the Medicaid-compliant annuity, in helping their clients qualify for Medicaid. And today I'm going to focus on the client's IRAs, because I think with IRAs, you know, they're more problematic. Most of us think of an IRA as something we don't utilize or take anything out of until we absolutely have to. But if you're in a state and the IRA is considered a countable resource, it has to be typically spent down in order to qualify for Medicaid. So to get away from some of the problems associated with IRAs, which the first one I can think of is, you know, the IRA money's pre-tax, so it would have to be taxed. We have to work with those funds in a certain way to minimize all of those negative consequences. So today the program I'm going to cover is called Strategies to Protect Your Client's IRA Using Medicaid Annuities. Now, again, you know, what I did in my estate planning practice is, you know, as a young associate, I really worked on other cases that my partners at the time had developed through revocable living trusts. And the trusts were really handy tools for handling someone's affairs should they be incapacitated or the death occurs. But the revocable living trust package really didn't do much when it came to Medicaid planning. And so as a result of trying to have a full service practice, knowing that those clients who had the best estate plans suddenly needed some help with qualifying for Medicaid, because without some help, all of their assets that they were trying to protect and preserve to get to the next generation wouldn't be consumed by the nursing home. And so Kraus Financial Services really is that tool that you would use as an attorney to find out more about whether it be long-term care insurance as a pre-planning tool, or you use annuities as a means to qualify someone for Medicaid, and those are your crisis clients. And then we have other products that, you know, can help with the planning, such as funeral expense trust and things of that nature. So our mission at Kraus really is to help you navigate the issues related to long-term care planning so that your clients get the best result. Now, today, my three goals are, first, I'm going to explore the Medicaid program and its rules surrounding IRAs. And then what I'm going to do is define the Medicaid-compliant annuity. You know, what is it? What does it have to have in order to be deemed Medicaid-compliant? And then I'm going to discuss how to use the Medicaid-compliant annuity when you have a client that suddenly has a retirement plan that is a countable resource and needs to be protected. So let's talk about the Medicaid program. We all know that the Medicaid program is a federally mandated program. Like Medicaid, Medicaid were developed in, I think, 1964, and they came out to help those individuals in need. And so the federal government dictates the rules, and then the states sign on by agreeing to follow those federal rules, and then the state will implement all of the eligibility applications and approvals. So for clients to be considered eligible, you know, they have to meet both financial and non-financial criteria. And even though the federal program should be the same in every state, states do have specific rules that are unique to the state. So you got to be very careful when you read an article and it's more general. You've got to look at your state-specific rules to make sure that there isn't something that can be a subtle change. Because Medicaid planning, it has to be perfect. If you miss something, you miss an asset, or you don't count the income properly, you can find that eligibility is not readily available, and that's always problematic for clients. So why is Medicaid important? Well, Medicaid pays for the bulk of long-term care in a nursing home for custodial patients. Now, nursing homes typically have Medicare patients which are there rehabbing from an illness or injury, and they go in and they want to rehab and get home. Those would be the Medicare residents. Whereas Medicaid is really the program that's designed to help those people who, you know, they're not there for a medical reason. They're there because they can't do all of the activities of daily living, which typically are thought of as eating, bathing, dressing, transferring, toileting. And the goal of the plan is really to keep them there receiving that custodial care for the remainder of their life. Now, when we look all across America and we look at the average cost, I know it's about a little over $9,000 a month for a two-person room. And the Medicaid program typically pays for care in a dual room, so it's two people to a room. And, you know, if you don't have Medicaid, you know, you can expect to spend $9,000 or more. Now, if you're out east in New York and some of the states like Connecticut, you can spend exceptionally more than that, probably $14,000, $15,000 a month. So I think the first problem most families face is how are they going to spend $10,000 a month out of the life savings and still provide some comfort and ability for maybe the healthy spouse? So people qualify for Medicaid in order to get that financial relief from having to use up all of their life savings. So when we look at the non-financial requirements, really we're talking about a U.S. citizen, age 65 and older. You know, I think of them as needing care. In other words, even though you're 65 and healthy, you wouldn't really qualify for a nursing home placement unless you need help with those activities of daily living. And then in order to get the Medicaid benefit, they have to be in a Medicaid-approved facility, typically a nursing home. So there's a lot of different care levels out there. You could have assisted living. You could have group placement, things of that nature. But typically, when I think of Medicaid, I'm thinking of a nursing home because most nursing homes take Medicaid. I think there's very few left that are private paid, if any. So the 99% of all nursing homes are going to be Medicaid approved. So when we look at the financial requirements, we really divide them between income and assets. So the income is separate and distinct from the assets. And so we have rules for each of those categories. So when we talk about income for an individual in the nursing home, so in other words, it could be an individual who's all alone, or it could be in a husband-wife situation, say the husband goes into the nursing home, the person in the nursing home has to have monthly income of less than the private pay rate in order to qualify. And I alluded to it earlier that, you know, with the private pay rate being $9,000 to $10,000, most people don't have that kind of income. Even the ones that sometimes have a long-term care insurance plan do not have the full ability to pay with all of their monthly income. So most people can qualify very easily when we look at the income standard. Now, if you happen to practice in a state that has an income cap, and in an income cap, is some states say that if a client has $3,500 and the nursing home is $9,000, but they're an income cap state, then you have to use what's called a qualified income trust to flow the income through in order for them to be eligible. It doesn't make sense to clients. Clients say, wait a second, I've got $3,500 of monthly income from Social Security and a pension, but because we're in an income cap state, I don't qualify unless I use a qualified income trust to conduit the income each month. And the answer to that is yes. If you're in an income cap state and the client has more than 2901, they have to utilize an income, qualified income trust, and the income flows through that trust. So it's a very simple trust document. Instead of having their Social Security income go directly to their bank account, we would float it automatically into that trust account, and then the trustee would just send it automatically to the nursing home. As long as their private pay amount is less than 2901, they would then meet the requirement to get around that income cap. So again, even though they have more than 2901, but yet they don't have enough to privately pay, they still need to use a qualified income trust if they're over the cap and they're at income cap state. Now, the institutionalized spouse's income typically all goes to the nursing home. They get a small amount, which we refer to as a personal needs allowance, so they can get things each month, a haircut, toothpaste, things of that nature. But if we have a husband and wife situation and the husband's in the nursing home, some of his income could be diverted to the healthy spouse because she doesn't have enough monthly income of her own. And we'll get into that. Now, when we look at the income requirements for a community spouse, now, again, we're talking about a situation, and we'll assume the husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home. There's no limit on the amount of monthly income the wife can have. So let's say she gets $20,000 a month, which probably would be unheard of, but let's say she gets $20,000 a month and he's only got $1,900 a month. There would be no income restriction in that case. She would keep all of her income and he would lose all of his personal needs allowance to the nursing home as his Medicaid copay. So there's no limit on the income of the community spouse. But we find more often that the community spouse doesn't have enough monthly income. So let's say the community spouse only has $1,500 of monthly income from Social Security. Well, I know that that's not enough because remember, you can have a lot or you can have not enough. When they don't have enough, then they get what's known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance. We refer to it as an MMNE, which shifts income from the institutionalized spouse to them to get to the proper level. And again, we'll talk about that when we get to the example. Now, the monthly maintenance needs allowance, again, this refers to a husband and wife case. The husband's in the nursing home, the wife's at home. She's got $1,500 worth of income. I know that if you're in a state where they have what's referred to as a minimum maximum, you've got to actually calculate the monthly amount, and we do that through their excess shelter expenses. So if you're in a state with a high-low, and about half the states are minimum-maximum, you've got to calculate what is the community spouse's shelter expenses, figure out what the amount is, take the excess, add it to the base amount of $2,643.75, and you come up with a hard number. So as long as the hard number is $2,643.75 or up to $3,948, that's going to be established as their monthly income need. So this, despite the fact they only have $1,500 of their own income, we would take it from the institutionalized spouse to get to the exact number. Now, if you happen to be in a state where they use just a fixed amount, let's say you're in a state and it's $3,948, we know that the community spouse, having only $1,500, is entitled to the difference between $3,948 and $1,500 from the institutionalized spouse. So if the institutionalized spouse, all of his income goes to her, his copay at the nursing home could be zero if it wasn't enough to get her to the $3,948. But let's say that, you know, he's got $4,000. Well, we know we're going to shift over enough to the community spouse in addition to the $1,500 to get to $3,948. The balance of his income, then subject to his personal needs allowance, then goes to the nursing home as his monthly copay. So again, you got to look at the state you're in and figure out what is the requirement for your state, and then do the calculation. Now, when we look at assets, we know the institutionalized individual, again, it could be a person all alone or it could be the husband and a husband-wife situation, we know that their asset limit is $2,000. So typically we tell clients, you can keep your personal property, your clothing, things that are personal to you that make the nursing home stay more comfortable, and you can have $2,000. That's the limit. If you have more than that, let's say they have $4,000, they have to spend down the $2,000 in order to be technically asset eligible. Now, the community spouse, so again, we're talking about a case where the husband's in the nursing home, see the wife's at home. That's a community spouse case. The community spouse is entitled to what's called a community spouse resource allowance, kind of like the MIMNA. But remember, the MIMNA dealt with income. The community spouse resource allowance deals with assets. So when we look at the community spouse resource allowance, like with the MIMNA, we have two different types of states. We have states that have a high-low, $31,548 up to $157,920. And then we have other states that recognize a flat amount of $157,920. So if you're in a state where it's the flat rate of $157,920, we know that the community spouse gets to keep that amount of cash. Now, again, we wouldn't keep exactly that amount. We would keep slightly under so that we're not standing at the edge of eligibility. But if you happen to practice in a state where you got a high-low, then you've got to look at their assets on what's referred to as a snapshot date. When did the husband first go in and get 30 consecutive days of care? We go to the first day of that period, and we look at their countable resources, and we divide them in half, and we say, what is the number? Well, I know if the total is 400, she gets 157,920 because half of 400 is 200. But the limit is $157,920. Now, if they only have $40,000, I know that she's going to get that $31,548 as the minimum. So, again, it's important to understand your state-specific rules and apply them to the case. Now, when we talk about assets, there's really two distinctions. You've got exempt assets, things Medicaid doesn't care about. Medicaid doesn't care about the primary residence, one motor vehicle, personal property and household goods, small life insurance policies, typically $1,500 of face value or less, and then funeral expense trust. So the primary residence can be a mobile home or it could be a modest home in a gated community. The vehicle could be a new vehicle, you know, it could be a brand new Tesla, or it could be, a very old car. It doesn't matter. You got one exemption for the house, one for the car. And then, funerals, we always recommend, if they want to do a funeral directly with a funeral home, they should. But if they want something a little more portable, then we would recommend a funeral expense trust. And that's a product that we offer here. Now, when we talk about countable assets, we say that everything that's not on the left side, on the exempt side, is countable. So we're talking about cash, stocks, bonds, cash value life insurance, immediate annuities that are not Medicaid compliant, extra pieces of real estate, extra cars, anything else that has value is considered a countable asset. And it's the countable assets that we look at when we're determining, the $2,000 for the institutionalized spouse and then the community spouse resource allowance. So what we typically do is we look at the countable resources and we take from those assets whatever the community spouse wants as her community spouse resource allowance. So let's say it is $157,000. She would pick $157,000 off this side. Now, most community spouses are going to take the checking account, the savings, all of the basic things, and then they'll take whatever's there. We then allocate $2,000 of those countable resources or assets to the institutionalized spouse. The rest of the assets have to be spent down, which means eliminated so that we can get Medicaid eligibility from an asset viewpoint. Now, when we talk about IRAs, this map really tells it well. Okay, IRAs in the yellow areas are countable. So you can see the majority of the states, if the wife has an IRA, it's countable. If the husband has one, it's countable. In other words, it's a countable resource. But if you happen to be practicing in the gray states, like Wisconsin, where I am now, I know that the community spouse's IRA is exempt. So think of it as an exempt resource. So it'd be on the left side of the sheet. If she has an IRA that has $100,000, we don't worry about it. Doesn't matter how it's invested or what it's in. If it's exempt, nobody cares, especially Medicaid. Now, if you happen to practice in the states in black, both are, both spouses' IRAs are exempt. Like I know in Florida, as long as they're taking out a monthly R&D amount, you don't count the value of their IRAs. So again, if you're in Florida, you take those IRAs, make sure they're getting a monthly R&D distribution, and you move it over to the left side of the page, meaning you don't have to work with those assets because those assets are not problematic. So how do we accelerate Medicaid eligibility when we find that we have things on the right side of the sheet that are still causing us an eligibility issue? In other words, they have value. Well, typically we tell clients, look, pay off any debt. So if you got a car loan, a mortgage, credit card debt, anything that you owe on, you can pay it down as long as it pertains to you. So they can't utilize the funds to pay down kids' debt or, you know, pay off student loans. They can only pay things that are connected to the party, so the husband or the wife. Now, they can also purchase or improve exempt assets. So I told you earlier that, let's say it was a mobile home, and the wife says, well, the mobile home's not really very good for me. I'm going to need a new home, and we happen to have $100,000 we need to spend down. Well, she could trade in the mobile home or sell the mobile home, use the $100,000 and get something that's a little more suitable. Or you could get a brand new home. You know, you just picked out a home. As long as you have the funds that are going to be spent down, those funds can go into that type of purchase. The same goes with the car. A lot of times we'll find the husband and wife, husband has an older truck and the wife has a car that's getting up there and she's going to be the only driver. Well, she can trade those in and get a new car. Or you can do the same thing with like furnishings in the house. Since they're accountable, really, they can upgrade the home, get the new windows, get the roof, all of those things. And certainly they should purchase, you know, funeral plans or get funerals out of the way because they're going to need them sooner or later. So those are good purchases. Now, the problem we have in making those expenditures when we're talking about an IRA is IRAs are pre-tax dollars. So if you're going to really use the IRA to buy a new home and you're going to liquidate a $200,000 IRA, you're going to owe taxes on those funds before you can access the money for the home purchase. So that's not really a good result in most cases. And what we really find is clients who are at that nursing home stage in life really aren't looking to get new homes and cars and things like that. They might be downsizing the family home. They might be eliminating the cars. Maybe they're not driving it much, if at all. So we don't see those things. But the problem with an IRA is when you liquidate a large IRA and you use the funds, you've got to pay the taxes, which then causes the Social Security income that is typically never taxed to suddenly be subjected to taxation. And so, again, I think we always look at it. I think the better way to work with an IRA typically is through a Medicaid-compliant annuity that's also IRA-qualified. So, you know, it's a good way to work with those funds that have to be spent down in order to find Medicaid eligibility. So when we talk about Medicaid-compliant annuities, we're really talking about an insurance product. The insurance companies that we work with, we help them to design their product. They're typically what we refer to as a single premium immediate annuity, but they have bells and whistles that have to be in the product in order for it to be Medicaid compliant. Now, the purpose of the Medicaid compliant annuity is to take something that's a cash asset and turn it into a future income stream. So by making the conversion, you're giving the asset, which is a problem, turning it into income, which is never a problem. As I told you earlier, in a case involving a husband or wife, if the husband's in the nursing home and the wife's at home, she can have any amount of income she can get her hands on. And so you can see where we're going. We're going to take the excess assets that are problematic. We're going to convert them into Medicaid-compliant annuities because Medicaid-compliant annuities have a future income stream, but they have zero cash value, meaning they're not an asset. And we can transfer an IRA into a Medicaid-compliant annuity that's also IRA-qualified. Now, one caveat is you can never mix IRA funds with regular funds. So if they have a bank account, that's a problem. just a, you know, let's say they have a bank account for $100,000 and they also have $100,000 IRA. We don't want to mix the funds together and buy one annuity because they're going to be, the distributions are going to be taxed differently. We want to make sure we always keep those funds segregated in the products that are utilized. So when we use an IRA MCA, it's not a taxable event. So if you liquidate the account and you use the funds to buy a home or a car, that's a taxable event. But when we use the IRA MCA, we're not creating a taxable event. So by converting it into the funds into an IRA MCA, there's no taxation. Now, the funds will be taxed as they come out of the MCA, as they're paid out. So funds received in a particular year, and again, they're usually structured with monthly payments, will be taxed all in that year. So again, we look at the level of payments. We try to keep them smaller than larger, and we know that we're going to have a tax liability. But by spreading the tax liability out over a number of years, we typically find that the taxation is not problematic. It's something they're already facing because our clients, once they reach the required minimum distribution age, have to be taking things out of their IRA. Now, most of our clients, if they're working with a financial advisor, will be taking on annual distribution off their IRA. But when we're working with Medicaid, typically doing a monthly payout. But again, our goal is to spread it out over a number of years, minimizing the tax consequences. Now, when we set up the IRA MCA, we can do it in two ways. We can use what's called a 60-day rollover, or we can use a trustee-to-trustee transfer. Now, I typically, we don't use the 60-day rollovers as often because it creates problems for the client, or it creates what I would refer to as what appears to be a problem, but it's really not. With a 60-day rollover, let's say the client has an IRA at their local bank, and it's in a $100,000 CD account. Well, they would go and they would liquidate it. They would get the $100,000 in the form of a check, and then they would put it in their bank account, negotiate, and issue, get a cashier's check or a personal check, make it payable to the insurance company, and then they would purchase the Medicaid-compliant annuity directly from the insurance company. Now, the problem with the 60-day rollover is at the end of the year in which they did the conversion, they're going to get a 1099-R, and it's going to look like it was a taxable event. The 1099-R is going to say they took out $100,000, and we don't know what happened to it, so we assume there's $100,000 of taxation. And then the client's going to get that 1099-R in January of the year thereafter, and they're going to call up and say, what is this? Did I get taxed on that IRA, that MCA IRA that I set up? Because it looks like I'm going to be paying taxes on $100,000. And that's the problem with the 1099-R. And so we typically recommend that clients do what's called a trustee-to-trustee transfer. What that means is they don't go in and liquidate the IRA. We fill out the paperwork. They sign the paperwork. And the paperwork allows the insurance company to go directly to the financial institution to get the funds. Because the client doesn't touch the funds, they don't get a 1099-R at the end of the year, which causes them concerns and they have questions. So by having a direct relationship between the IRA custodians, the insurance company is an IRA custodian, and, you know, the bank is an IRA custodian, the client, you know, doesn't face any of those issues or questions by receiving that 1099-R. So when we look at an MCA, we've got to look at it and say, well, what is it? I said earlier it was a single premium immediate annuity, but it has to have all of these features. Now, every insurance company really offers single premium immediate annuities. And if you ask the companies if they have a Medicaid compliant one, they'll say, well, I think so. I think our product meets the requirements. But most insurance companies, when you look at their products, you will realize that they're not irrevocable. And they're not irrevocable from the standpoint that when you have a Medicaid-compliant annuity, it has to be irrevocable from the standpoint nothing in the product can change. You can't change the owner, the annuitant, payees, the beneficiaries, can't change payment amount, duration of payments. Everything is locked down. With most traditional immediate annuities that insurance companies offer, you can change the parties. So companies like J.G. Wentworth, Peachtree Financial, want to buy those streams of payment. If they can take control of it, then, of course, it has value. And if it has value, then it's still an asset. But with a Medicaid-compliant annuity that we offer, it's irrevocable from the standpoint nothing can be changed. Now, the next requirement is that it be non-assignable. In other words, the owner of the product. So if we have a husband and wife and the wife buys the annuity, she can't assign the payments or the contract itself to a third party for value because they can't get their name on it. And so, again, being non-assignable is what Medicaid compliant, it proves it. It makes it valuable because by being irrevocable, non-assignable, no one can find value in the product because they can't get their name in it. Only the community spouse's name is in it and nothing can be changed. Now, actually sound just means that the product has to pay out all of the funds within a certain time limit. And normally we meet that time limit. Most clients go shorter than longer, so that's never really an issue. Now, the fourth requirement is equal payments. Every payment from the contract has to be identical in amount. The product can't have a balloon payment, you know, a big payment at the tail end, can't have inflationary payments. They have to be identical in amount. And the last requirement is the state has to be beneficiary. So if the wife buys a contract with the spend-out amount, she has to name the state as primary beneficiary to the extent of her husband's Medicaid expense. So if she predeceases the term, the state recovers from what's left in the annuity by offsetting what it paid on behalf of the husband, who is the Medicaid recipient. And that's why most community spouses will typically go shorter than longer, getting the money well within their expected lifetime. So when is an MCA appropriate? Well, we never use MCAs as a planning tool unless we've got a family that's in crisis. So you don't use it as a pre-planning tool. Typically, I say you've got to have the client where we've got an individual in the nursing home, or we've got a husband-wife situation, say the husband's in, and they're in the nursing home, they're getting custodial care, they're going to stay there the remainder of their life. They've used up all of their benefits, whatever benefits they might have had, because some people do have long-term care insurance, and they might be able to pay their way, but they used up all their long-term care and Medicare benefits, and they're paying out of pocket, and they have assets that they're spending down. That's the client you want, and not until then. Again, a lot of times clients will come to us and they'll say, I'm worried about it. Worrying about it isn't the time, because when we do this type of planning, we have to make sure that we understand who's on first, who's on second, who's on third. So if we assume the husband's going in and we do the planning for the wife, and then lo and behold, the wife goes in by accident or otherwise, and now the husband's at home, the plan would fail. So we never engage in this type of planning until we have what we refer to as a crisis case. So let's talk about the first case study. This IRA is owned by a community spouse. So here we have Paul and Julia. Paul's 83, Julia's 81. Paul's in a nursing home. Excuse me. Julia took care of Paul for a couple of years before he had to go. She reached a point where she just couldn't provide the care anymore, and it really wasn't safe to keep him home. He was losing his mobility. She was having a tough time getting him dressed. She checked with a couple health care, home care agencies, and they just suggested that because the level of care he needed was pretty much 24/7, it was only fair that, you know, he would go into the nursing home. So Paul enters the nursing home, and it's costing $9,000 a month. Now, Julia's concerned that looking at what they have in the bank, that it's not going to take long to go through that if Paul spends any time in that nursing home. And she's worried about what happens to her. Her health is outstanding. She expects to reach 100. She's got longevity in her family. And there's no reason why she's not going to get there. And she knows that when Paul dies, you know, they're going to lose one of the Social Security payments. And she's going to have less to live on. So her fear is that Paul's long-term care expenses are going to consume their life savings, so she turns to an elder law attorney for help. Well, we look at the case facts. We got Paul's income of $2,400, primarily Social Security. Julia's income is $2,100. It's a good income. Between the two of them, they have $4,500 a month. Now, they have total countable assets. Now, again, we're not worried about the house, the car, the furniture, personal property, the prepaid funerals. They have $350,000 in bank accounts, of which $100,000 is Julia's IRA. And Paul's cost of care is $9,000. So we asked, Julia, how much of the $4,500 do you have available to take care of Paul's bill? And she said, well, I feel I have some, but I don't feel comfortable because I have times where I really need the funds available for my needs. So there really isn't anything. And so the first thing we do is we say, well, look, you got $350,000. If you divide it by $9,000, you got about 38 months worth of private pay in that nursing home. And she says, well, wait a second. You know, I'm only 81. If we use up all of the funds in 38 months, what am I going to live on? Because it took us 50 years to save these funds, and I really can't afford to lose them that quickly. So the concern is, what do we do? Well, we suggested Medicaid. So in this case, we suggested two MCAs in order to get Paul eligible. We said, you know, your $100,000 IRA, you know, you can keep it as part of your community spouse resource allowance, but because you're taking RMDs now, she's taking required minimum distributions, we might as well continue. So let's put the $100,000 IRA MCA in an IRA, in an MCA IRA, you know, as a way to spend it down. And then we'll use the balance of the spend down amount and buy a second Medicaid compliant annuity for her, which then eliminates the problem assets. Now remember, setting up the IRA into an MCA IRA for her is not a taxable event. She will be taxed on it as it comes out in the form of monthly payments. So the first thing we got to do in their case is figure out, what are we going to spend out? How many of the assets does she get to keep? So the first thing we do is we know the total countable assets are $350,000. We know that Julia gets one half. Well, one half is like $175,000, but there's a limit. The limit is $157,920. And so we tell her, look, you could keep $157,920, but if we're off by a penny and you're over, he would not have eligibility. So we tell her, keep $155,000. She then takes $155,000 from the bank accounts and maintains that in her own name. Now we grant Paul $2,000, so we got to spend $193,000. Now, I told you earlier that she has a $100,000 IRA, so we know what's going to happen. We're going to take $100,000, put it in the IRA MCA, and then we're going to take the $93,000 and put that in a regular MCA, one that's not an IRA. So the first thing we've got to do is, well, let's assume we're going to do the annuities. How long do we write them for? Well, again, Julie thinks she could live, Julia thinks she could make it to 100, so do we write it that long? The longest we could go would be 106 months, but we also had to remind Julia that if something happens to her and she predeceases the child, in other words, whatever child we pick, she predeceases, the state's primary beneficiary to the extent of his Medicaid expenses, so the state would recover. So knowing that, Julia said, well, you know, I'd like to go longer than shorter because I know when Paul dies, I'm going to lose one of the Social Security checks, so I'd like to have a steady, reliable flow of income. So we said to her, look, we typically use a longer term when your health is good. In your case, your health is good. You've got longevity. You've told us that. And you're not going to get a shift of income under the MIMNA rules if we're going to spend down these other assets because we're creating that additional income. And the funds are tax qualified. So we typically try to go longer because of the taxation issue. Now, generally, we told her we use shorter terms in the community spouse's questionable health, or her income is so low. We use shorter term when she wouldn't be entitled to any of Paul's income, because, in other words, it would be a lower net worth case. We would use a shorter term because we want to keep a larger payment to her so she has enough to live on. Or we use a shorter term when, you know, the family says, I'm worried about a state recovery. I don't want the state to get these assets. So in Julia's case, meeting with the attorney, they opted for a 60-month plan. She felt at age 81, you know, a 60-month plan would be perfect. So now Julia is going to be the owner payee of both MCAs. She's the owner payee. The primary beneficiary, as I told you, would be the state Medicaid agency to the extent of Paul's care. And then the contingent beneficiaries would be the couple's children. Now, what do we know about Julia? She told us she's going to make it to age 100. Her health is perfect. She's got longevity. So we assume, and she assumes, that she's going to get all this money back because she's going to live 5 years, which will then make her age 86. So she's very comfortable with this, and she likes the reliability of the monthly payments. Now, with the non-qualified one, $93,000, she gets $1,560 a month for a total payout of $93,600. Now, you can see these products don't pay a lot of enhancement. They really were designed for asset protection planning. And then the tax-qualified one, again, she's the owner, annuitant, payee. She's going to get $1,680 a month, and she's going to get $100,800 as a total payout. So each month, she's going to get $3,240 from these two MCAs, along with her other monthly income. And so her total monthly income, once we implement these products, she'll have $5,340 a month. Now, I told you earlier, they had $4,500. She said it really wasn't enough. This amount made her very comfortable, and that's how we kind of came up with the plan. Now, when we calculate Paul's Medicaid copay, we know that Julia gets to keep all the income that comes into her name, so there's no limit. So despite the fact she's got $5,340, she keeps it all. Paul, on the other hand, has $2,400. He gets $50 a month for his personal needs, so he can get toothpaste, a haircut, whatever. So his copay is $2,350 a month. For his nursing home stay, that was $9,000. So here we took a family that was worried about losing everything in 39 months, and we're now saving $66.50 a month. And Julia is very comfortable spending $23.50 on Paul's care. And she has reliable monthly income for 60 months. She doesn't expect Paul to be around forever. She kind of told us that, you know, if he needed 2 years, she thought it would be a long time for him because he was getting worse. But the end result is, here we took a family that was worried about losing all of their life savings over the course of 39 months, and we protected it all pretty much for Julia. Because what did she lose? She didn't lose anything. We gave up Paul's monthly income, but that's a small amount in light of that $9,000 payment that they were experiencing before. And remember, the sooner the clients get to you. So a lot of clients, what happens is they transition into the nursing home, and then they start paying privately, and then they start doing the math. In this case, she did that. They paid for a few months, and she realized, you know, this is going to cost a lot, and it wasn't, her life savings weren't going to last. So in meeting with the elder law attorney, they then put the plan together and implemented it as soon as they could, and so this was the result. So she was very delighted with the final outcome, because it really made economic sense to her. Now, what happens if Paul owns the IRA? So in that case, we had the total countable resources. We had Julia owning the $100,000. Well, in this case, we'll assume Paul owns it. How does it change what we've done? Well, Paul can only have $2,000. We told you earlier that he can have $2,000. So if he has a $100,000 IRA, and it's countable, we have to spend it down. Well, the way we're going to do that is we're going to use what's called the name on the check rule. The name on the check rule pertains to MCAs. And what happens is we eliminate the asset problem, the $100,000 IRA account in Paul's name, by putting it into an IRA MCA. And what we do with it is Paul's the owner, he's the annuitant, but we make Julia the payee. So Julia is going to get the monthly payments, and Julia can also be the primary beneficiary because Paul owns the annuity. The community spouse always has a preference over the state when the product is owned by the institutionalized spouse. So the name on the check rule, everyone says, well, where is this filed? What's it? Really a Medicaid rule, and you'll find it in the 42 USA code, and we got the identified here, 1396R, parents 5, subparents small b, 2, capital A, small I, and it states, if the payment of income is made solely in the name of the institutionalized spouse or the community spouse, the income shall be considered available only to that respective spouse. So this rule is unique to Medicaid. It's not the IRS that says it. Medicaid says if the monthly check comes in the form of a person's name, it's their income. It doesn't matter who owns the product, all of that. They just, Medicaid looks at the monthly check. And so the name on the check strategy, was really designed to prevent the income from being part of Paul's income. Because remember, if we didn't use the name on the check, now Paul would get the monthly payment. It would be part of just total copay to the nursing home, which would drive it up. It's not a bad result. I mean, whether you use the name on the check or not, I think when you use the name on the check, you're getting, 100% result. But let's say the client says, well, I don't feel comfortable doing the name on the check. I'd rather just leave it in Paul's name. Well, Paul still is going to pay substantially less to the nursing home than $9,000, even with this additional payment. But in states where we can use the name on the check rule, we typically do this. Now, we're not changing ownership of the product. Paul still owns that IRA MCA. So he gets the 1099 at the end of the year. It just so happens the contract makes the monthly payment to the community spouse. So with the interest of the spouse, the community spouse can be the primary beneficiary. So if we had a case and let's say Paul dies, then instead of getting the monthly check as the payee, Julia then gets it as the primary beneficiary. And so that's the way that it works when the institutionalized spouse owns the product. So, again, she wins by being the payee while he's alive, and at his death, now she picks it up as beneficiary. So considerations. Typically, we always recommend going over the longest term possible with using the full Medicaid life expectancy. So we would go over Paul's full life expectancy. So that way, if we did get a challenge, we didn't make it so short that we'd be giving the payments as part of Paul's income to the nursing home. So we try to minimize it. We also request paper checks because paper checks are what we would use in a fair hearing. So if someone says, well, we understand the name of the check rule, show me the check with the community spouse's name on it, we could show the checks. We would get copies of all the checks and those would be our proofs. And we've done that. Now today, a lot of people want to do everything electronically. And as you know, when working with banks and bank accounts, you can't always tell when it's an electronic deposit, if it was her name or his name. But when you have the actual hard check and she endorsed it, cashed it, it's very easy to assume whose name, who had the right to negotiate that check. Now, considerations. Let's say you have a case where the husband and wife both have small amounts of income and the wife needs a lot of income. We don't really have to use the name of the check rule because even if you put it in Paul's name, if all the income is going to go into the community spouse to get her up to the MIMNA, we're not going to worry about it. Or if we have cases where the IRAs are so small, someone has a $10,000 IRA, we just typically recommend liquidating it and just pay the taxes because, again, it's minimal when we look at a small IRA account. We're more worried about the $50,000, $60,000, $100,000, $200,000 IRA accounts. Now, here's the case study in the name of the check rule. So again, Julie is going to purchase one of the MCAs, but she's going to do it with the non-qualified funds. Paul is going to buy the IRA MCA with the $100,000. Now, by making both purchases, we eliminated the $193,000 of assets that were the problem. So Paul is going to be immediately eligible for benefits. And remember, because we didn't liquidate. Some elder electricians will say, well, I'm just going to liquidate Paul's IRA. We're going to pay the tax, and then we're going to give the excess funds to the community spouse. The problem with that plan is, one, you're paying a high level of tax because the more income you stack on top, it gets taxed at higher rates. And by having a high level of taxation in 1 year, 2 years later, they're going to find that their Social Security is going to get taxed because their Social Security typically doesn't get taxed unless someone has an excessive amount of income. So again, we never recommend liquidating Paul's IRA and giving the net to Julia. So the first thing we got to do in this case, because again, we're talking about the same facts, $93,000 and $100,000. Julia is going to keep the same 60-month plan as she did before. And then Paul, because he's 83 and male, he can stretch it out to 79 months. So we're going to have Paul's MCA IRA go out 79 months. So you can see the two annuities. The non-qualified one, $93,000. Julie is the owner annuitant payee, states the primary beneficiary. The children are secondary beneficiary. On the second tax-qualified one, Paul is the owner annuitant, and Julie is the payee, and Julie is the primary beneficiary, and the state is secondary beneficiary. So again, two annuities owned by different individuals. So when we now apply for Medicaid, Medicaid says if you've eliminated the $193,000, let's look at what goes where. So Julia's income is $2,100. She has the MCA income. She's also entitled to the income from Paul's MCA because she's the payee. So her total income is $4,940 a month. So it's more than that $4,500 we have together. And then Paul's side, Paul still has his $2,400, keeps $50 for his personal needs, and his copay is $2,350. So that's all he's going to pay. So again, you can see, despite the fact that Paul has a $100,000 IRA and he has to get down to $2,000, we did it very simply by using the name on the check rule with an MCA for Paul. So again, what are the economic results? Well, again, they're paying $2,350, so the savings is the same, $6,650. It's better than paying $9,000. Julia's income didn't get as high as the first example, but we did get to $4,940, which was more than the $4,500 they had initially, which makes her very comfortable. And Paul doesn't have any income tax consequences as he would if he had liquidated the IRA and gave the excess funds to Julia to spend out. So at this point, it looks like we're ready for some questions. Amy?
Alrighty here. Okay, the first question. Let's see. My client likes the idea of protecting his IRA, but would prefer to use a promissory note rather than an MCA. How should I respond to him?
Well, the problem with promissory notes, because promissory notes are like, I view them as a competitive product to the MCA, but the IRA rules do not allow you to handle your own IRA funds. You have to have an IRA custodian. So if you were to utilize the funds with a promissory note, they immediately he would have what's called a prohibited transaction. He would be taxed on the entire account value as though he had done a liquidation. So I would advise the client that you cannot use a promissory note when dealing with IRA accounts. You have to use an MCA or an insurance product.
All right, next question here. In the first example with Paul and Julia, if Paul passes away after 18 months in the nursing home, what happens to Julia's Medicaid-compliant annuities?
Yeah, in that example, Julia had two annuities, both with terms of 60 months. She had her $100,000 IRA MCA, and she had her $93,000 non-qualified IRA. Because they were structured over 60 months, at Paul's death, because the contracts were owned by her, they would just continue making payments for the balance of the 60 months. And so that's what happens in that case.
All right. And then there's a follow-up question to that one. So in the second example, using the name on the check rule, what happens to Paul's MCA if he passes away after 18 months?
Okay, because, in that case, he had the IRA MCA. It was in his name. He was the owner annuitant. Julia was the payee. If he dies 18 months into that plan, Julia then is no longer the payee because now she's referred to as the primary beneficiary. She would continue to get the balance of the payments as the primary beneficiary. So again, it would continue its payout, and Julie would continue to get the monthly payments by way of being designated as the primary beneficiary. Any other questions?
Yes, just a few more here. If Paul or Julia had a small IRA account, let's say $15,000, would you recommend the IRA MCA for them?
No, again, I kind of touched on that a little bit where I said if their account's small, I think the worry that most clients have with IRAs is they know that there's taxation issues. But with an account of that size, let's say they liquidated and they bought a funeral plan or something of that nature, I don't see the income tax consequence to be significant enough. Because the amount is so small, it really wouldn't make sense to have a MCA IRA. So I would generally advise them just to liquidate the account and feel comfortable with the liquidation.
All right. Let's do one last question here. If I have a case and I'm unsure of the best plan, will Krauss Financial help me with that?
Yeah, I built the company on the premise that, you know, I knew how to do all of this type of work. I knew how to perform the calculations and all of that. And so if you have a case and let's say it's your first one or second one, and you're not really sure, because again, I think clients worry when we start talking about IRA accounts, just give us a call, send us an email, pick up the phone. Let's go over it, because we want your clients to be happy, because this business was built on happy clients. If your clients are happy with you, you're happy with us, and together we can fulfill the obligations. And I think, you know, we're more powerful as a team. And so if you have a case and you're unsure of which way to go, you know, let us take a look and give you a plan. And if they like the plan, we'll move forward. If not, there's no obligation to us for at least exploring what's available to them.
All right. Thank you, Dale. I saw a few additional questions come in. We are at the top of the hour, but don't worry. We will have someone follow up with you folks later this week to get those addressed. Otherwise, a recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your attorney access account. If you haven't already created an account, you can head on over to krausfinancial.com/join to get started. Signing up is quick and easy and gives you access to all our latest educational content and Medicaid planning resources. And I want to thank you again, Dale, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.